Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel. And today we're talking to Merlin Chaquinune, who is the Donald H. Gemsen Assistant Professor of Sociomedical Sciences at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And he is also the author of All Health Politics is Local, Community Battles for Medical Care and Environmental Health, which just came out this summer with the University of North Carolina Press. And we are excited to have him on the show. Dr. Chaquinune, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Clark. I'm really happy to be here.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, like education self and stuff like that. Like
education self, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I always like hearing about that, like trajectories of scholars, not just historians, but how they got to places. And I think mine was pretty random and serendipitous. So I definitely did not want to be a historian at the outset of college and really had no notion that this was a legit line of work that one could pursue. So it sort of happened by a series of accidents. But I would say the first light bulb was I took a class with Eric Foner at Columbia on the history of radicalism in the United States. I was sort of involved in social movements and activism myself in college, and so wanted just kind of a historical perspective on it. And this was a class I took in freshman year, and so it made a big impression on me because, I mean, one, it was just a very lively class. It was interpretive. It was not just a bunch of names and dates. And he was a spellbinding lecturer. So I think that got me curious about history. And then I took a class on archival research with Betsy Blackmar, who is some of your audience members may know, written a lot of, they can only be described as muscular histories of Central Park and early American Manhattan, just like the sheer amount of archival research. So she's the one who really kind of taught me how to go through 100 boxes or something and try to get some kind of narrative out of it. But I think the most important person I took a class with was Sam Roberts, who is a very distinguished historian of public health and wrote a very important book on the Jim Crow South and TB in Baltimore. And he taught this class called History of African American Public Health Movements. And if the class had one argument, it was essentially that you can't tell the story of public health without realizing that public health is both a kind of institutional project to be admired in many ways, but also an institutional project that had an underside to it and that marginalized a lot of people and didn't work for some populations and not others. Dr. Roberts would always kind of remind us that one of the high points in traditional public health history narratives was the progressive era. This is also the high point for eugenics. So it was a great class that kind of explored that contradiction. So Roberts was the guy who really kind of kind of got me hooked on not just history, but the history of public health and knowing what it was, and then racial inequality within public health. He had me read this book called Origins of the Urban Crisis, which was about Detroit and its economic decline in the 1940s and 1950s, and how that was bound up with deindustrialization and racism. And it was by a guy named Tom Segrew, who at that time was a history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And so I read that book, and there was a particular article that came out of that book called Crab Grassroots Politics, which was about suburban racism and homeowner associations that tried to repel, sometimes violently, Black home buyers. And it was a horrifying but also a marvel of historical research, just going through these like homeowner association papers and local newspapers and things like that to document this. So I was like, I really got to study with this guy. So I went to University of Pennsylvania with the express intention of studying with Tom Segrew and another historian who unfortunately passed away a few years ago from cancer, Michael Katz. And Katz kind of took a sort of similar approach to social welfare as Roberts did, that this is, you know, forms of public assistance have obviously been very helpful to millions of people, but they also have a punitive underside to them. They assume a lot about the behaviors of poor people. He had a book that made a big impression on me also in undergrad called The Undeserving Poor, which was about where does this notion that there are some poor people who deserve assistance and that there are others who should be shunned, where does that come from? And so Katz was a big influence on me too, and I wanted to go study with him. And then at grad school, there were three other scholars who I think were pretty big for me. David Barnes was a historian of public health of France and kind of taught me to interrogate, again, sort of like Roberts did, what are public health's fundamental roots? And turns out they were a little unsavory, right? A lot of, especially if you look at England and France, a lot of very bound up with kind of Victorian era ways of regulating poor people. So Barnes taught me a lot about myth busting. And then the two others were Adolf Reed, who I can talk a little bit about more later, but really just changed how I thought about race and its relationship to capitalist structures. And he and I have worked closely on a number of things since. And then I think everybody should have, I mean, sometimes graduate students will ask for advice and stuff. And I always recommend having just a rando on your committee who does like absolutely nothing that is remotely related to what you do, but just like read stuff and says smart things and can have you read smart books to help you improve your writing or argumentative skills. And that rando for me was Steve Hahn, who is a 19th century historian, and wrote a book about the origins of about yeoman farmers, which was kind of like a precursor to understanding populism. And then wrote a book on, I guess I would characterize it as kind of like, what is the social history of Black nationalism? And so, but he taught me so many different things, even though, you know, we did a readings course on the history of capitalism and transitions to capitalism from feudalism. And I used none of this stuff in my, in dissertation or the book, but it still taught me a lot how to think. So those are my folks. Yeah.
That's an amazing group of mentors.
Kind of by accident. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's fantastic lineup though.
Yeah.
How did you come to write All Health Politics is Local? Was this your dissertation?
This was my dissertation, but it had kind of a lot of bumps and detours. So I came in thinking I wanted to write a dissertation on health activism in the 1960s and 70s. And there is a lot of health activism in this book, but in a very different form than that project that I originally thought of might have taken. So that project, I was really interested in a group of about two dozen activists and certain health activist groups, like very specific groups, particularly medical student activists in the 60s and 70s. But I ended up not doing that for the dissertation for a couple of reasons. One was, this is probably a foolish thing I did, but I went directly from undergrad to grad school. So I was like 22. And I did not think that I was politically mature enough to be writing about health activism and these kind of heady debates and interpersonal conflicts and things like that. So there's part of me that just didn't feel prepared to write about that stuff. But I was also learning kind of new things, ways you could work with quantitative data, ways you could think more about the policy aspects to public health. So I wanted to kind of apply that stuff. And so gradually, I think my dissertation shifted so that I didn't forget about health activism entirely, but I was also very interested in the broad policy structures that constrained activism at times, in which all activism was embedded. And I really started to develop an interest, too, in what you might call backyards, the actual locales, immediate environs where people lived, and how they experienced public health. And so I think that's where I got the idea to do a book that I hope has a feeling of national sweep, but that is ultimately grounded not in national level stuff, but local stuff. So yeah, it was kind of like, I think a lot of people enter grad school with an idea of what they want to do, and then they learn more stuff and switch course. So I think that's what happened.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the title. So the title comes from the adage that was popularized by former Democratic Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, that all politics is local. And your variation on that is all health politics is local. And this kind of becomes the analytic framework for the book. I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I ripped off the late Tip O'Neill shamelessly and basically just inserted the adjective health in front of his very famous quip. And what he meant by that was that there are these big national swings in national politics, but really, if you want to understand them, whether it's civil rights or changes in attitudes on women or right-wing backlash, you can't just look at what's going on at the national level in DC politics. You have to look at a place like Orange County, where a lot of this stuff bubbles up, or something like that. So I always thought that was a good framework for understanding public health, but it wasn't quite crystallized, and it took me a long time to get there. So this was a dissertation, and then I didn't look at the dissertation for like 2 or 3 years. I was burnt out. I just, the thought of looking at that thing again was for a couple years was something that made me very fearful and intimidated. So I just didn't touch it for like 2 or 3 years, and was working on other stuff at this postdoc I had. But I think I was struggling. I had a lot of material for the dissertation, but I didn't have the right frame for it. So the original frame was not localism. That's not what the dissertation was framed at. It was about the division between medical care and everything that is not medical care. So some people may know this in the audience, some people may not, but there's this perennial debate in public health about how much medical care actually matters to improving public health. And I think the general consensus is it matters way less than we think, that even if everybody in the country had great medical care, we would still have a lot of public health problems for a host of reasons outside of medical care access and the medical care system. So I wanted to do something with that. And that was originally how the dissertation was framed. It was about Here are some cases that are about medical care, and then here are some cases that are not about medical care, environmental health cases. But it seemed kind of too esoteric a framing. I think people in public health would get it, but I think people outside it outside of it wouldn't. So I said, nah, that's not the right framework. It doesn't come as intuitively to as many people as I would like. So again, I kind of went to the dissertation, struggled with the framework, and then got scared and put it away for like 6 months. I kept doing this, kept kicking the can down the road. At some point I had to actually write the thing. So I came back to it, and I have a writing spot. I don't know, Dr. Clark, if you have like a writing spot where you go away to, like here in the Northeast.
Oh, I wish I did.
Here in the Northeast, everybody likes to go to the forest. And I don't. I'm not a forest guy. I don't like ticks and stuff. So I said, I'm not going to a forest, but I definitely needed to isolate, you know? And so my sweet isolation spot is Miami, Florida, and particularly South Beach. So I went to South Beach and I locked myself up for like a week. And I said, we are going to figure out this framework and we are not leaving South Beach until we do, which might have been a mistake because it's a strong incentive to stay in glorious South Beach. But went to South Beach and thought about that, kind of read the dissertation again. And then at the same time, I brought some kind of political history books with me. And there was this volume that was edited a number of years ago now by Julian Zelizer, Meg Jacobs, and I think Bill Novak. And it had actually a Tom Segrew essay in it. And the Tom Segrew essay, like Tip O'Neill's quip, was called All Politics is Local. And in that essay, Segrew talks about how even with the growth of the federal state and the federal government, local impulses are still important. And so there was kind of this sudden light bulb in my head. I said, that is what you are writing about. Like, fundamentally, you chose to do local studies. You chose to do local studies because you thought studies that were too centered on the national level and particularly national quantitative data sort of missed the thicket of what goes on at the micro level on the ground. And local strategies are also what all of your actors in this tale are ultimately get behind, you know, these kind of local grassroots bottom-up strategies. That is the framework for your book. So Tip O'Neill bailed me out and Segrew bailed me out. And that was how I kind of came to use that framework. Yeah. But it was kind of a weird thing. It's like, you know, the text of the book is probably like 70% the same as the dissertation, but that 30%, you know, made the difference, the wrapping. And sometimes it's the wrapping that I think people get stuck with in the revision. I don't know if you had that experience
we're not here to talk about my dissertation first book, but I definitely think it works. And you say in the book, you say that most of our synthetic accounts of health politics are at the national level. And when I think about the books that are out there about public health, I think that's right. I think, you know, this does fill a gap that exists. And I'm curious how you chose. So you look at health activism in New York, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Ohio, and Central Appalachia, and your time period is from the 1960s to the 1980s. How did you come to research these places and this time period?
No, great question. So there's both intellectual reasons and then fake reasons, there's intellectual reasons that are somewhat fake and somewhat real, and then there are real reasons. And very few historians, I think, cop to the real reason, but I'm going to. So New York was close to Philadelphia, where I was doing my dissertation or it was going to grad school. So I could count on friends to who would let me sleep over while I was doing archival research in New York. I'm from Los Angeles and my mother still lives there, so I could stay at her house. So boom, already you got free lodging at two places. So that's the kind of non-intellectual reason. The real serious, more serious reason was I was very interested just in the war on poverty in general, as a period, the war on poverty in Great Society is a period of substantial federal government growth, but also a period and a set of programs that I think don't quite get the regard and the respect both among the general public and historians that they deserve. So there's all this, you know, literature on the New Deal, and then literature that more recently has pointed to the more unsavory aspects of the New Deal, how some aspects of the New Deal may have simultaneously created a new social safety net while also creating racial inequality and marginalization. And I've always thought it kind of curious that people don't look to the Great Society and the War on Poverty as a foil to that, because the War on Poverty and Great Society, as flawed as many of the endeavors within them were much more inclusive than the New Deal. A lot of that New Deal baggage that I think has been explored in both the public sphere and by scholars is actually addressed in some ways by the War on Poverty and Great Society. And I think if you're looking for an example of an ambitious federal government program, set of programs, this is where you might look. But so I was kind of very interested in just the history of this period, and noticed that the War on Poverty, and particularly a federal agency that was essentially created to administer the War on Poverty, called the Office of Economic Opportunity, or OEO, so OREO without the letter R, OEO, I noticed that they funded a lot of health programs, and particularly what we now call community health centers. So these are low cost, sometimes free places where you can at least get primary care. And usually they had kind of some interesting social service functions as well. And I noticed that the first ones were all open in the four regions that I chose. Los Angeles, one of the first ones was in New York. Cleveland had one, Central Appalachia had one in Eastern Kentucky. So that was kind of the thread, was you follow OEO and follow OEO to places that have good archives. So these were, and places you can live for free at least some of the time, so which was LA and New York. The ecological story, the environmental health story, was a little trickier. So Los Angeles, just growing up, I knew is a place with a very troubled past when it comes to ecology then and now. So I knew there was probably a story there, and there was. And then Central Appalachia I picked largely because at the time there was a lot of, this was like, I don't know, 2010 or so, there was a lot of scientific literature appearing on coal mining, and particularly this process called mountaintop removal, where you essentially explode part of the mountain to get to the coal seam. And it's a pretty devastating process, just for ecology, but also for human health. And I wanted to know the history of that. And so that kind of made Central Appalachia a potential prospect for another environmental health story. And that's how I picked that. So there weren't, I didn't want to just pick a basket of random places. I was looking for kind of some threads. And so OEO was a thread for the medical care side. And then for the environmental health side, eventually I was looking for a strong comparison and divergence in success. And so LA in the book was a success story in terms of controlling environmental health problems of the time, and Central Appalachia was not. So there was kind of a nice foil there and a nice entry point to a comparative analysis.
Great. Yeah. Instead of going sort of location by location, my questions, the rest of my questions are all going to focus on different tensions that the book covers, sort of the various different battles that are in your subtitle. So I'll ask you to kind of talk about more than one of these cases at once, I guess, instead of going in order through each of the towns, each of the locations, which I think would be kind of boring. So I'm going to ask some bigger picture questions.
Okay.
So in each of the locations, New York, LA, Cleveland, Central Appalachia, there is a tension between the community and the medical institutions that are supposed to serve it. So in New York, there's a problem of the sustainability of public hospitals. And in Los Angeles, there's a problem of medical maldistribution, so a lack of health services in the predominantly Black Watts neighborhood. In Cleveland, there's a problem of access, and that is that the renowned Cleveland Clinic exists amid a blighted and racially segregated neighborhood. And then in Appalachia, there's a problem of mismanagement of government funds that are intended for the improvement of local health services. Can you talk about what each of these stories have in common in terms of the tensions between the community and then the medical institutions?
Yeah, no, that's a terrific question. I think there's like maybe two or three kind of common points, even though, you know, because one of the arguments of the book is that you have to go local to see local variation and how local idiosyncrasies impact what are common health problems in very different ways. So there's a lot of difference among these four places that are due to local characteristics, unique characteristics, but there are also some commonalities. So I think two or three of them are. The first is just like an extraordinary faith in local imperatives and changing things at that level. So in the case of Cleveland, it's not the problem wasn't that there was no health care in Cleveland. Cleveland then and now is actually famous for having a lot of innovative health care infrastructure, but the problem is a lot of that health care infrastructure is only open to people with deep pockets. And so the idea was to open healthcare up and extend it to places that had previously been denied it. As you mentioned in the Los Angeles South Central Watts example, it's somewhat different. It's built where it never existed. But the common thread in all of this is to do stuff at a very local level, particularly in the form of new facilities or changing the facilities that existed. So it's kind of this faith, this local imperative, this local thrust. That's one commonality that threads it, and it's also projects that involve local people. So this is not these are not endeavors where some functionary from a Washington DC agency is called in from outside. There's particularly in the Los Angeles and Central Appalachia case, there's a lot of faith that people who live in the neighborhoods and need these services are also people who are going to be a critical part of building them. And I guess that gets to the second commonality, which is an extraordinary faith, much of it validated subsequently, much of it, I think, a little bit of it misplaced, but a huge faith in community participation. That is the notion that people shouldn't just be passive receivers of services that medical doctors and other wonky experts make for them. They should have an active part in shaping the nature of those services and shaping the administration of the institutions that they rely upon. And this is something that's kind of in the air just in broader American society in the 1960s and 1970s. So it was a very famous phrase that was made popular by the group Students for a Democratic Society. participatory democracy. So this is, you know, the notion that there are lots of powerful institutions that we all have to, that we are all reliant upon in our day-to-day lives. And they are very, the actual inputs that we have on how they're run and how they serve us are actually foreclosed. These are insular. And so the notion of participatory democracy is, people should have a say in the kinds of institutions that shape their lives. They shouldn't just, again, be passive receivers of those institutions' actions. So I think community participation is the second thread running through this. And it actually becomes part of government policy. So the agency, the War on Poverty Agency that I mentioned earlier, the Office of Economic Opportunity, in the law, in the federal law that created that agency, it said that any local project getting money from this new allocation needed to have community boards that were composed of non-professional lay people, and the board would sort of serve as a community check to the usual kinds of experts who ran things. So I think the second is participation. And then third is more in the form of a problem. I think all of these local endeavors, particularly in the medical care sector that I examine, are always wrestling with the problem of scale. So you have one great project in one neighborhood, but ultimately that's just one project in one neighborhood. And even that one neighborhood project can't serve everybody in that neighborhood. So how do you actually expand this so it's not just this one isolated node that's a success, where even though the rest of the system is deficient? And I don't think they quite solve that problem. And I think many local endeavors today are dealing with the scale problem. So there are a lot of your listeners may know of community level NGOs who do amazing work, but they do amazing work that may improve the lives of 5,000 people when there are actually 500,000 people in a city that need their lives improved. So I think the problem of scale and both the beauty and potential, but also the huge limits and constrictions of localism, that's a third theme. So they all kind of are rooted in the, as you pointed out, the analytic frame of the book. They're locally driven, and there's extraordinary faith in kind of bottom-up community-driven projects. There's a lot of faith in lay people actually having real administrative control to an extent in these projects, community participation, and then there's this persistent problem that's lurking in the background, which is how you're actually going to scale this up so it's just not this one local victory here, another local victory there. Yeah.
I think it's worth pointing out to our listeners that you actually do a wonderful job of capturing the perspective of the communities that you talk about. So you've got all access to the OEO records and to the medical institutional records, but then throughout the book, you find the voices of the folks on the ground who are sort of doing the work. And it's really sort of flesh the art, like you go beyond just what's available in the archive so that you're able to capture these local community perspectives.
Yeah, and here I gotta thank, and this is kind of a thing that became apparent to me both in writing this book and researching kind of community health topics, is that as you say, there's a lot of stuff you can find out about the bureaucracy and the government agency aspect of it in your traditional archives that are held in libraries, academic institutions, the national archives, and things like that. But those are often missing, as you say, voices of actual people who experience and live through these programs. And the key for me was actually going old school and picking up the telephone and identifying some of these people and calling them. And I found one thing that people really are happy to do is actually just give you their old crap that's been accumulating for like decades. So, you know, there's one story. So I spend a lot of time talking about this, just one example, this Lower East Side, New York community health center that's still around today, actually, called Gouvenir. Lower East Side serves Chinatown and the broader Lower East Side area. And I knew kind of casually somebody who had worked there in the 1960s as one of the first community organizers for the new community board that had formed there. And, you know, her job was to actually go out into the neighborhood and tell people about this this new institution, but also find out what some of their needs were. So I knew about her. Her name is Terry Mizrahi. And so I contacted her and she said, yeah, you know, I have a closet full of stuff from my time at Gouvenir. And it was just like these newsletters that were impossible, that, you know, you couldn't find anywhere. They're just like newsletters with voices of patients, little kind of memoranda that she wrote to herself, back and forth letters between her and some of the other employees, and that gave you the sense of the ordinary people who use this facility much more than your traditional government documents. But it all came from just asking Terry, hey, can I borrow this stuff? And she said yes. So I encourage anybody listening to not be afraid to pick up the phone or email people who whose names you stumble across, because they might just have a bunch of stuff that can help you get those voices for sure. Yeah.
What a gold mine. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two more questions about sort of common themes in the book. Two of the battles discussed in the book are over environmental health. So there's the story of smog in Los Angeles, and then the story of, as you mentioned, strip mining in Appalachia. Can you tell us a little bit about those battles? Why did the campaign against smog in LA succeed while the campaign against strip mining in Appalachia failed?
Yeah, no, a great question. So, I mean, the Los Angeles story turned out really differently than what I had expected. One of my favorite books is this polemic by Mike Davis, Ecology of Fear, about my hometown of Los Angeles. Basically says, like, Los Angeles has all the preconditions for, like, ecological catastrophe. And in some ways, he has been proven right by the periodic fires and that have occurred in Los Angeles in the past decade and so forth. So I thought I was going to kind of do like, I would do Ecology of Fear, but with a little more archival depth, perhaps. And I thought there would be like more of an environmental justice story here, because Los Angeles then, and to a certain extent now, still has a fair amount of oil drilling that is proximate to vulnerable, low-income minority neighborhood. So I thought it would be an environmental justice story when I went back to the 1940s and 1950s. That story is kind of there, but it is really not the main event. The main event, and it just kind of hits you in the face when you look at the archival documents, is what you said. It is the pervasiveness of smog and smog attacks in the 1940s and 1950s in Los Angeles, but also the triumph of a very aggressive air pollution program that markedly turned around the situation, not entirely, as anybody who grew up in Los Angeles knows, but substantially within about 20 years. And so that was the puzzle, is how does smog go from being a, and it's, you know, like I said, I grew up in Los Angeles, like everybody takes pot shots at Los Angeles for being smoggy and polluted. And we certainly have those days, but it is nothing compared to what it was in the 1940s and 1950s. There are accounts of people who you know, they step outside of their houses and involuntarily they just start crying immediately because something is getting in their eyes and triggering that response, or all kinds of nasal problems, sinus problems. There are smog blankets in the city where the entire where Los Angeles just goes dark for a day. that doesn't happen now. So it's like how did this happen? And so that's how I wanted, that was the puzzle of why I wanted to study Los Angeles. Why was this so successful? It's not a place, you know, you think, you know, given what you know about Los Angeles politics, 1940s, 1950s, it's not necessarily a progressive town. So why this happened? The Central Appalachia story was kind of the opposite. So I knew already in some ways that attempts to mitigate the ravages of mining, and particularly a technique called strip mining, surface mining. So this is when huge tractors and bulldozers come and deforest land, and then very forcefully using mechanized methods dig up until you can find a coal seam. I already knew in some ways that it was not, the attempts to control this were not successful, because surface mining has been going on until recently at a very rapid pace. And as I mentioned, it's sort of evolutionary endpoint is this brutal mountaintop removing technique. And so I want to know why in one place you have very successful environmental health mitigation and in others you don't, and it's full speed ahead on ecological destruction to get coal. And what I ended up coming to was I think two reasons, and they might be instructive too for climate change politics. I've been thinking a lot about that. But in Los Angeles you essentially have a coalition of odd political bedfellows that nonetheless unite around combating smog. And so one critical part of this is the most obvious, is these are just kind of neighborhood level local environmental activists who send crabby letters to constituents. They form ad hoc organizations saying something has got to be done about smog. But it's not just them. They sort of lock arms with a subset of the Los Angeles elite, the Los Angeles County Medical Association, which in other contexts is a completely reactionary right-wing association, really gets behind the smog battle, because all these physicians who are members of it see their patients coming in with smog-related illness. And but I think the most important actor in the coalition is kind of the recreation and tourism industry. Because if Los Angeles in 1940s, 1950s marketing itself as, you know, sunshine city, beautiful utopian coastal place to shoot movies, to go on vacation, and there are smog blankets, like, it kind of undermines the whole marketing thing. So the recreation industry also played a big role in pushing for smog. And I argue they essentially back the industrialists, which are oil and gas companies and the steel industry, into a corner, and they capitulate and say, okay, we'll go along, we'll try our best to go along with this smog mitigation. And it's essentially an inter-capitalist competition. And I've always just thought, as just a political strategy, if you can exploit divisions between capitalists, that can often be one of the major turning point in any kind of endeavor. And I think you see this again with this climate bill, because there are lots of for-profit big companies that are putting a lot of money behind renewable energy, whether it's for kind of a social justice, social responsibility reason, or just because they want to cut their own kind of energy costs. And that has been, I think, a critical part in advancing this new bill. As important as climate activists are and environmental activists, this new bill actually has a substantial amount of corporate support as well. And that's what happened in Los Angeles too. The non-industrialists kind of got behind it. I think the other reason was kind of an ideological reason. So I come up with this term that I call the industrial ecological accord. So this is the unspoken rule that you may pass very aggressive air pollution measures. They may really annoy the industrialists, but you're not going to fundamentally pump the brakes on growth, and particularly huge economic growth in a city like Los Angeles, which was a boom town in the 40s and 50s. You're going to really just kind of sand the edges off of it. So you'll say that one, a steel foundry can't emit a certain amount, but you're not going to actually stop the number of steel foundries that might be built. You're not going to stop highways, even though you might push auto companies to limit the kind of emissions that come out of a single vehicle. So the Industrial Ecological Accord is this kind of agreement from industrialists that they'll try their best to limit emissions and adhere to rules, but the fundamental growth imperative is not going to end. And so I think that's one reason they also sort of agreed to get on board. The foil is Central Appalachia. There's no kind of coalition like this. Kentucky, as you know, has a lot of energy interests that still play a disturbingly large role in government. It is a state that is very dependent on those energy companies. So whereas Los Angeles had a lot of economic diversification, Kentucky had much less of that, especially in the time period that I talked about, which is kind of 60s, 70s, early 1980s. So you don't have these inter-capitalist tensions that you can exploit. You don't have, the environmentalists don't have these powerful allies like the Los Angeles County Medical Association or a huge recreation Hollywood type industry that they can form alliances with. So because you don't have the alliances, it's basically like the environmental health activists by themselves opposing something that is central, not just to the Kentucky economy, but the American economy, because there was a period in time where most electricity in the United States came from coal, and came not only from coal, but coal from this Appalachian region. So the odds are very stacked against the activists in Kentucky in a way that they aren't in Central Appalachia, that they aren't in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, I have one more question about commonalities. So you work in a college of public health. I work in an academic medical center. Some of the people listening to us might be in a similar boat. I really think that this book has lessons for us, those of us who work in academic medicine or in colleges of public health, in terms of town-gown relations. Can you, using some of the examples from the history you tell, from what you learned while you were doing your research, can you tell us what are some things that universities can do to foster effective community involvement?
That's a great question. I teach at Columbia, and particularly this is a university that, let's just say, does not have stellar relations with the neighbors, with its neighbors then and also now, to be quite frank. The medical center, which is located in Washington Heights, low-income, predominantly Latinx neighborhood. There's a lot of tension, and there's a lot of bad things that the medical center has done, particularly with regards to real estate expansion and getting people either directly or indirectly kicked out of their homes and stuff. So this is something I think about quite a bit. But in terms of what people like us who work in these institutions, and particularly might feel uneasy about working in an institution that does these things, I think there are a few things that you can take from the lesson from the book. And particularly, I'm thinking about the Cleveland Clinic case. So the Cleveland Clinic, as Dr. Clark mentioned, is located on the east side of Cleveland in a still very under-resourced, deeply segregated neighborhood. The name Cleveland Clinic makes it sound like this kind of quaint, modest institution, but it is not. It's like when you walk through that neighborhood for the first time and then you see the Cleveland Clinic, it's like this extraordinary glass spaceship that you just see the money and how expensive it is just by looking at the physical plant itself. So I think about that example the most in terms of drawing lessons that people in other institutions like the Cleveland Clinic that are located in similar places can do. I think the most important thing is actually just a certain mindset. So I find, and I found this even in my short time working at Columbia, that there's usually a tempest that gets people paying attention to town and ground relationships, like some kind of protest or some kind of big current in American society, as we saw in 2020, and then people start to look at their own institutions, and they issue indictments of how their institutions behave. But then what happens is after like 6 months to a year, that foment starts to dissipate, and that is what happened in Cleveland. So in Cleveland, in 1966, there was an uprising in Cleveland around racism and police brutality and segregation and under lack of resources, and a lot of anger, as there was in a number of other cities across the United States. And so the Cleveland Clinic has to go on the defensive because people are starting to point fingers at, well, what is the Cleveland Clinic's responsibility now that these sorts of demands are being made? But then what happens is that after, you know, some time, people forget. So there's like this huge spike in interest, and then it's a lull. And then when you go to the lull, everybody sort of just forgets about the problems. And I found this cycle even here. And so I think one lesson is you don't take your eye off the ball, even when the tempest is over. So when that initial groundswell of interest is done, that's actually when you need to be most committed, not during the period when everybody on campus is angry, but maybe the period when only 20 people are upset. You got to keep pushing and not forget what happened. So that's one thing. I think the second is to think harder about what community means. So often the solution to town and gown relations is to involve the community more, but we often use it in this sort of hazy way. And I think we need to be more precise about how we identify who is part of what community participation entails, who is a member of the community, what kinds of organizations do we bring to the table. It's often done, I think, in a kind of hasty, unthinking way. The third is, I think you got to have some respect for leadership and structure. And this is something where people might disagree with me on. But, you know, in my book, there are lots of conflicts over the community participation demand. Who is part of the community? How much control should the community have? Let's say you're running like a medical institution and you commit to building a community clinic in a neighborhood like Watts or Washington Heights or something like that, and you commit to community participation. Does that mean that the community members, however you define them, should have control over every single detail of the institution? Probably not. It would probably be unworkable after a while to just have to do have a quorum on every kind of tiny little hiring detail or infrastructural improvement. And so you need some leadership and structure that still preserves the overall spirit and goal of community participation while actually being logistically reasonable. And I think there's a case in this book around Watts and this kind of community health center that was built in Watts where they did that. They initially initially had a lot of squabbling over what this community board's mandate was, and then they changed it more to a board of directors type of structure. And I think that's actually a good one, a board of directors that is not composed of the usual kinds of people who are on boards, but that also takes more of a bird's eye approach to running and running things and giving input rather than micromanaging. And then the last, and I sometimes laugh at this because it doesn't seem that sophisticated. It's not like a super, I don't know, theoretical, conceptually rich kind of observation. But the one thing that I found hugely important when you're trying to mend town and gown relations and improve community participation and the community stake in an institution is good interpersonal skills. You just need people who are really good at diffusing conflict. So when, you know, a community organization becomes furious at some administrator at the university and things get very vitriolic and heated, you need people who can actually bring sides to a table and diffuse the conflict and actually forge a path forward. And I think that's actually a really rare characteristic in activists, in organizers, in advocates, just people who have this kind of sixth organizer sense of how to be a good human. And there are a couple people in this book who I actually got pretty emotional researching them because I was like, man, like we've got this person is so good at observing, you know, micro level human behavior and understanding how to navigate it. And particularly the Watts people, there's these two. One was a physician named Rodney Powell, and the other was a community organizer they hired named Jack Bates. And I found Powell, and he was kind enough to actually show me some of his papers, but I couldn't find Jim Bates. I really wanted to find him because he just wrote this poetic stuff about like the structure of the Watts neighborhood and all the different factions and why they sometimes didn't like each other. And he just had an extraordinary sensitivity. And again, I say all this stuff because it's hard to put in academic terms, this interpersonal skills part. But, you know, as somebody who has been in some activist movements too, I've seen activists clobber each other and really end up hating each other. And you always appreciate the people who can serve as, you know, a temperate glue voice, the glue that brings people together after those kinds of moments. So I think interpersonal skills and identifying people in academic institutions who have those skills and who can communicate credibly to community members is huge.
Well, you talked a little bit about the problem of scale. That brings us to your conclusion. You conclude the book by arguing that what's needed now isn't localism as it existed in the late 20th century to people like Tip O'Neill, but something that you call, and this is a quote, a multi-scalar health politics. Can you tell us what that is and how did your views on community health change while researching the book?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. How did I get to multi-scalar politics? Well, you know, I entered this book with extreme skepticism about localism. Like, I'll be frank, I thought local politics and local health, community health endeavors were kind of dopey, that they were permanently bedeviled by the scale problem, that they fetishized small is beautiful type projects. So I was already, when I started writing this book or doing the research for it, to dunk buckets of cold water on localism. I thought that would, and there are these, you know, really kind of books that have come out recently that really attack community level stuff for along these lines. So I thought I was going to do the same. And then I started to actually find that I admired a lot of these projects a lot more. As I said, I got actually pretty emotional reading about the Watts project and also some of the achievements that are still standing. You know, that Watts Community Health Center is still standing today. Gouverneur is still standing. Some of the reforms that were forced on a parochial institution like the Cleveland Clinic still exist in some form or the other. So these were not as inconsequential as I thought. But I think the most important thing to me was I then asked the question, well, if localism isn't as ineffective as you seem to think, Merlin, then why do so many people still gravitate towards it? And I think they gravitate towards it because look at the health sector. It is one of the most still hierarchical, exclusionary sectors there is. There's just not a lot of levers people can pull besides local. You know, like, are you really going to get an audience with some health policy wonk in DC who works in those kinds of corridors? Maybe, but it's a lot harder than just sort of trying an endeavor out in your own neighborhood. So I think, you know, I started to become much more sympathetic to it because I realized that the local is the dimension where people who otherwise have no access to things that control their lives might be able to make some kind of entry point. But I also think you got to be sober and honest about, again, the scale problem and how effective these local projects can be, especially in our climate now. So you and I, our generation, has been permanently living in like an austerity regime. Like every big city that I've lived in is always going broke. Like every year there is like a budget crisis in New York City. And you look at the social services or just public services more broadly, you can see they're kind of teetering. And when you look at that and you look at this kind of new political economy that started to emerge in the 1980s of, you know, a lot of austerity, a lot of decline in the robustness of public services, it does make you ask, well, okay, you've made one great local project, but, you know, it's really a minor dent in this new regime. And so I think we need to be honest about what that new regime and context looks like. And that's what I mean by multi-scalar. It's both continuing these local endeavors, but also we got to keep our eye on the bigger context in which these local endeavors exist. And that's often on state, federal, and even global level. And I thought about this even more with the two of the biggest crises of our time, which is the climate change crisis and the COVID crisis. With climate, you can have one city like Seattle that has super forward carbon neutral policies, but it's going to take more than one city or even 100 cities to do this. This is a global thing. If one nation, particularly a very large nation, decides to be a profligate, carbon non-neutral nation, it's really not gonna matter in the grand scheme of things how these, you know, like individual here and there successful municipalities are handling a climate. The climate bill is sort of interesting, this latest one that passed, because it's an example of muscular federal action, but a lot of that money is actually going to go to local projects. So in some ways, that is kind of a multi-scalar politics being enacted, I think. I thought COVID was another very sobering thing for me. Like, we all know that more at the beginning of the pandemic than the end of the pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, there were lots of cities and states and even countries that were doing really well. In the book, I briefly mentioned Kerala state in India, which kind of had all the public health measures you wish the United States had. But then all of a sudden, like, you know, more deep into the pandemic, the Kerala COVID rates skyrocketed. And question was why? And it was because of migrant workers that came through Kerala. And it was an example how, you know, our world is very interconnected, so that even if you have a stellar public health program in one place, inevitably there's going to be a porousness with the rest of the world. So you can't just think about it in a one region sense. It's got to be a multi-region sense. And so that's what I mean about multi-scalar projects and multi-scalar health politics. And I think if it sounds abstract and kind of hard, it's because it is. And I think if people knew the magic formula beyond that, we wouldn't be in the situation we are in now. So I mean it as a heuristic to kind of start a conversation more than anything.
Well, it's very well said. Okay. And Merlin, we have taken up a lot of your time, and This brings me to our traditional final question here on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on next? What's next for you?
Yeah, I'm kind of working on three things. So I sort of reactivated that health activism project that I talked about earlier. I'm in this weird position now where I am now older than any of the people I'm writing about in my book were at the time they were doing the things I talked about. And I just mentioned that because I think I have a little bit more political maturity to write something like that. So I've been working on this book about medical student health activism in the 1960s and 70s, and particularly focused on something we talked about, which is town and gown relations and the way these medical students forced that issue, but also the limits of some of their activism. But I've also been working on kind of a couple of things that are sort of new for me in terms of the genre. One is not so much a history book. It has some history in it, but it's a synthetic book on what are often called social determinants of health, that is non-biological, non-medical influences on health. And it's trying to take stock of this literature that looks at the impact of income, education level, race, gender, a host of other things on health, and what that body of work tells us, but perhaps what it also misses. It's mostly like a couple generations of epidemiological quantitative work, and I thought it might be interesting to look at it from the vantage point of a historian. So it's one book, and the other is to look at the history of public health. Again, more of a synthesis of the literature than the sort of research I did for All Health Politics is Local, but it's kind of using COVID as a jumping point to reconsider a lot of themes in the history of public health. So, you know, I definitely did not, it comes out of this thing I did about COVID and the Trump presidency, this little chapter that I wrote for a book, and sort of now expanding, but I didn't want to just write another COVID book, because I think like 1,000 of them are coming out. So I'm not interested, but I do think COVID is an interesting entry point into a lot of issues in the history of public health, as well as a way to rethink a lot of things in public health. One thing I'm rethinking, just to give an example, is I don't know if you do this, Dr. Clark, but I used to do this in my history of public health classes, where I basically go in and I'd say, all right, until like maybe the mid 20th century at the latest, there was lots of infectious disease. And then the infectious disease fell, and we're not going to worry about that anymore. Yeah, and it's now all chronic disease.
Yeah.
So this COVID has profoundly changed how I think about that. I threw those lectures out. I mean, it was already problematic because of HIV/AIDS, but there's also a lot of infectious disease that we kind of just shunted aside with that narrative. So kind of using COVID as a lens, weirdly, to think through the history of public health and rethink it. Yeah.
Well, those are three great projects, and I hope you'll consider coming back to talk to us once they're written and published and out in the world.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.